I'm up on a tight wire.
I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire, where our guest today is poet Elijah Burrell, who we'll be speaking with about his debut collection of poetry, The Skin of the River, which just came out with Aldrich Press. And then we will have a special treat for you on Poetic License. El Paso-based musician Kitsani Montaño Sevilla is in the studio with us today. But before we get into that, spring is in the air. April is upon us. And I know all of you have this on your refrigerator posted that this month is National Poetry Month, right? And for me, this is the time of year where I encourage my friends and family, and myself included, to partake in all things poetry. Sometimes I will read poetry to my children, and I encourage you to do the same, or to write a poem to a significant other, or submit a letter of resignation to your boss, or in poetic form, whatever you want to do, but enjoy the benefits of poetry. This is also the season where I usually go out on my annual teaching tours. And each spring in since 2006, I've been doing this with Poets and Writers magazine. I travel around California Central, San Joaquin Valley, and it's a beautiful place, agriculturally rich area. And I get to go there and teach poetry to rural communities, mostly to youth. A lot of them are farmworking communities. You know, this kind of sharing of poetry, one thing I've learned over the many years of doing this, you know, it's really a benefit, especially for young folks. And so for National Poetry Month, I always try and aim my attention at the young folks. And I'll tell you this story of, I think, of where this one time, at least, this one glimpse of that difference was just palpable. It was in Stockton, California. This is a couple of years ago, and there was this mother and her three children. They were two girls and a boy. The two girls were older, and they were the only ones actually who happened to be at this workshop. It was at a library in rural Stockton, so it was – I don't know how well it was publicized at the time. But anyways, they were the ones that were there, and I've always felt like, you know, those who show up to these workshops are the ones who are meant to be there. And indeed, that was the case. The youngest boy, whose name was Jesus, he was about 15 years old, and he was this really shy kid, and his sister. So after we had done the workshop, you know, they all wrote. Even his mother sat down and wrote poetry with us. And after the workshop, his sisters were really, they're extroverts, obviously. They were just sharing their poems and weren't afraid to talk about their poems, and the mother shared it, her work as well. And then it was Jesus's turn, and Jesus was obviously, he was really shy and timid. And he kind of clutched his paper close to him, and he began to read his poem. But when he began to read, there was this sort of certainty in his voice, a bit of confidence in his voice in the way he was reading, and his poem was fantastic. Anyway, when he was done, I started to, you know, congratulate him on the poem and, you know, obviously encourage him, tell him how great it was. And he, you know, he was just kind of retreating, I could see. And so his mother felt like this need to explain, and his mother says to me, you know, Tim, Jesus actually, you know, his issue is that he was picked on when he was in elementary school. He had by his teacher. She said he had a teacher who would put his English down in front of the other students, so he would come home saying he was dumb. And as his mother was telling me this, Jesus, sort of out of nowhere, he whispers, he says, "Red and red." And so I look over to Jesus and I go, "What's that, Jesus?" And he goes, "Red and red." And then I said, "What do you mean?" And he goes, those were the two words that I would keep getting mixed up. Red as in I read the book, and red as in the color red. I would get them mixed up, and I would spell them wrong, and my teacher would make fun of me for that in front of the class. And then here he was, you know, sort of having this liberation, this freedom to write and to use language to his own creative whim. And so I told him in that moment, you know, I said, hey, you know, well, here in this case, especially for National Poetry Month, spelling doesn't matter. Right? What matters is getting the poem out, expressing yourself creatively. And I told him what my friend, the poet Maria Melendez, actually, I think she's Maria Kelson now, who lives in Pueblo, Colorado. Whenever she enters a classroom of children, she screams at them and says, "You are the boss of your own poetry." And then she does the Oprah Winfrey thing. "You're the boss. You're the boss. You're the boss. You're the boss." And all the kids go, "Yeah, I'm the boss." I think part of the teacher is like concerned. And the other part of the teacher is like, you know, "Yes, you're the boss." And, you know, it's so important because I can't tell you how many times I've seen adults steal away the creative potential from children. And I feel like this is an opportunity, this National Poetry Month is an opportunity to say, forget all the rules. Let's just play with language. Let's have fun with language. So if you're a poet, writer, parent, teacher, you know, enjoy the benefits of poetry with the youth out there. And also, actually, there's a lot of great programs if you're a little more serious about it, too. There's a fantastic program based out of Austin, for example, called Barrio Writers Workshop that's run by Sarah Rafael Garcia. And there's like chapters of that in Houston, Los Angeles. I know Phoenix had a chapter. Writers in the Schools is everywhere. Houston and Colorado have it. So celebrate National Poetry Month. And with that, stick around for Elijah Burrell on Words on a Wire.
There's a place out on the edge of town, there, rising above the factories and the fields.
The Skin of the River is a debut collection of poetry by Elijah Burrell, who hails from Jefferson City, Missouri, where he teaches writing and literature at Lincoln University. His work has been published in numerous anthologies and journals, including the Birmingham Poetry Review, Swink Magazine, the Penwood Review, and too many to name. He's the recipient of the Jane Kenyon Scholarship at Bennington, Vermont, and he also received his MFA in writing and literature there. About his book, award-winning poet Amy Gerstler says, "Burrell gives us the grit and spark, the immediacy, the beating heart of a place and its people with all their magic, guts, grimness, and gusto." Eli Burrell, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. Hey, are you calling us from Jefferson City? Is that where you're at?
Yeah, I'm calling from Jefferson City. I'm actually in my office at Lincoln University.
That's in Missouri, right? Jefferson City, Missouri?
That's right, yeah.
Wonderful. And have you lived there your whole life? Is that where you're originally from?
I'm originally from Columbia, Missouri. It's about 30 minutes from Jefferson City. And then I grew up in a small town called Ashland. Population, when I lived there, like, 1,000. And it's kind of situated right between Jefferson City and Columbia. So I'm close to where I grew up.
Oh, okay. Okay. So that's home. That's home base for you.
It's home.
The Skin of the River, fantastic collection, like I said. And one of the things that leaps out at me about the collection is your sense of place. And we've talked to other poets here on this program about that. And for you, though, I guess one of my specific questions is, the Skin of the River is the title. What river are we talking about?
Well, it's really any river. Nice. Water kind of plays a theme. It's its own character in the book, I would say. And that line, the Skin of the River, was in a poem that was originally in the book, and kind of at the last minute I pulled it out. Mm-hmm. But I liked the title so much that I kept the title.
Right.
Ashland is kind of situated just a few miles from the Missouri River.
Right.
And to get into Jefferson City, you have to cross the Missouri River. But Missouri, we have the Mississippi River, the Missouri River.
Sure.
So here in the Midwest, you kind of grow up and you've got rivers all around.
So then, I guess sort of on a broader scope of that same idea, tell us a little bit about the place that these poems here inhabit or that the poems are about or took shape in wherever you wrote. Tell us about the place about this collection.
Well, obviously the Midwest and the South are kind of a different thing.
Right.
And one thing on the back of the book, a few of the quotes and the blurbs call the poetry Southern poetry. The two individual regions were kind of lumped together, though.
Right.
And I would not claim to be a Southerner because I'm not. And this probably isn't what people would call Southern poetry. But, I've been in the South enough. My dad grew up in the South that I feel like I can write competently about it. But this book actually is, many of the poems take place mid-Missouri. We're talking fields, we're talking gravel roads, we're talking rivers, creeks. They would be considered regional poems, I think. I've heard a lot of people say that. And, some poets kind of blanch when their poetry is considered regional because they think that it's kind of being shoved into a box.
Sure, right.
But I try not to think of it as one of those boxes,
It's like
my mom grew up in New York. Mm-hmm. My father is from the Florida Panhandle, so neither of them are from here. So I had both of their influences as I was growing up. But I've lived in the Midwest and Arkansas for a few years, my entire life.
Wow.
So it's true that I grew up kind of living in the country, the woods, creeks, gravel roads, whole deal. But so, the memories and, the sensory images of those days are still kind of fresh, in my mind.
Of course.
But some of the poems in the book, they'll kind of communicate that, when you put me in a high-rise, in Manhattan, or, truck me off to Chicago for a bit, you start seeing that kind of place in my poems. So,
right.
That's why I say I don't like to be put into that box.
Sure.
But I understand why people would say that. Yeah, absolutely. Sure. It plays a part in all poetry, I think.
Right, right. We're speaking with Elijah Burrell about his new collection of poems, The Skin of the River, out with Aldrich Press. You know, one of the things you mentioned, actually, you mentioned Southern poetry or Southern poets. Another sort of, I think, theme or genre that came to mind as I read is eco-poetics, because there is so much sense of, you have a real sort of your sharp eye on the flora and fauna as much as the people of a place. You know, you have sections that are like, you have a poem called Frogs, for example, which is, I love that poem. It's a fantastic poem. A poem, A Storm of Flies. There's lice. There's all kinds of, you know, critters crawling around in these poems. And, you know, I wondered if there are certain writers along these lines that like sort of eco-poetics, maybe that, you know, whose work maybe has influenced your own.
As far as eco-poetics go,
and I use that, really, and mind you, I use that term loosely too. I mean, you know, that could mean that's a broad sort of, there's a broad definition. But, you know, just writers who kind of have their eye on the natural, quote unquote, natural world.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's tons of writers out there that I look to for that kind of thing. Those poems you mentioned are from kind of that middle section, the plague songs. So those are frogs and lice, and those are from the plagues.
Right.
But, you know, poets that kind of have that feel for the earth and for, you know, one of my favorites is the poet Morris Manning. And he talks a lot about, you know, he lives on a farm, I believe. He's kind of the real deal. I've got a buddy named Greg Brounderville that wrote a book called Gust. He deals with the Delta, the Arkansas Delta,
right.
A lot of natural images in that. And, you know, for people like Manning and Brounderville and, you know, myself who kind of grew up in these areas, it's kind of in our blood.
Right.
Yeah, so I would probably name them. Melissa Range is a poet who has a book called Horse and Rider. It's a fantastic book. It also deals with the natural world a lot. She deals with that in her poetry.
Is she the one that was published with the University of Texas Tech Press?
That's right, yeah.
Right,
that book,
yeah.
Horse and Rider, won
That's
that
right.
contest.
Yeah, we share the same publisher that year. I think we both had our books published that year. There.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
You know, someone else who kind of talks about the weird natural world and does it in such strange ways. I got an anthology of his poetry in the mail yesterday, and it's the first time that a lot of his work has been available to the public, not in these hard-to-find, you know, small press versions. And that's Frank Stanford, who I was I've loved this guy for years, and there's just not much by him out there. But Copper Canyon just put out this fantastic, like 700-something page book. Mm-hmm. Full of his poems, somebody to take note of, probably.
And then, you know, you mentioned that section there in the middle called Plague Songs.
Yeah,
and, you know, about that, one of the things that I instantly, actually, as I was reading, especially when I got to that part, and throughout the collection, actually, there seems to be this conversation with God, or at times you're addressing God directly as you, right, the second person, you. And here on Words on a Wire, we've talked about another poet before, Andres Montoya, who wrote a book called The Ice Worker Sings. And as I read your book, and I would get to these parts that have this real sort of spiritual or sort of obvious spiritual connection, it made me think of his work, who, because I knew this guy, because I knew the poet, Andres Montoya, personally, I knew that he was a devout man of God. And at one time he actually said to me, you know, I write for God. And even knowing this, whenever I would read his work, I never had the sense that I was trying to be converted, you know? It was always this using God as this sort of spiritual sense or background to his poems, as a sense of rootedness. And so it opens it up, right? It opens it up for the reader then. And I get that same kind of feeling from your poems, even as you're speaking to the you, to the higher you. And so I'm wondering, you know, how intentional was that move on your part, or what role does spirituality play in your work as a poet? As a musician, too, because I know you're a musician as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I'm glad you picked that up. You know, I love the sense of mystery, the sense of grace and faith. Over the last couple of years, my mom has, like, she got really sick. She actually succumbed to myeloma in December. And that she was going through that when I was writing parts of this book. And, you know, when she got really sick, I knew I had to do a few things.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, I was looking kind of for an idea, a series of poems to kind of put in the middle of the book, and this series, these plague songs, kind of came out of that. And, you know, I wanted to kind of express what it means to suffer tremendous but like random loss, seemingly random loss,
right,
not understand why it's happening, you know?
Sure.
No matter how strong the faith, not really understanding why it's happening.
Right.
And, you know, with something like myeloma and like many cancers, the doctors, they can tell you how it's spreading,
right,
you know, how the numbers look, but they can't really tell you why.
Right.
And I'd been reading in Exodus, you know, in the Old Testament, thinking about like how brutal the plague story is.
Right, yeah.
And imagining like what would it be like if something similar happened here, like around where I live?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the why in the Old Testament is kind of clearly to secure like freedom for the Israelites. But
right.
I wanted like this onslaught of frogs and lice and fire hail suffered by this character like Randy Fairlow to be like irrational, unrestrained. Why is this happening? You know, but you know, in the middle of all that, and in the middle of Mom's situation when she was kind of getting worse and worse, I understood that there has to be music, there has to be humor in that horror, you know?
Right,
and I tried to kind of liven up the language in these poems,
right,
keep them memorable with like these like mnemonic devices, alliteration, right, rhyme, anaphora, et cetera.
All that comes through, definitely.
Yeah.
It does.
But I think there's some intentionally humorous moments, and sometimes there's some, I'm hoping there's some shocking moments,
right,
and that was kind of the point, you know,
right,
to kind of keep that sense of mystery, that sense of like, where is God in all of this?
Sure.
You know, that kind of that, it's a cliched thing to
right
say that, you know, but there is the sense of faith in this character, Randy Fairlow, mm-hmm, and even through all these trials, there are these questions that come up,
mm-hmm,
and because of these trials, these questions come up, and that's what I was really trying to get at in those 10 poems. I'm glad you picked up on that.
You know, you mentioned characters like Randy Fairlow, or, you know, even, and I call them characters because there's several different names that you, the names themselves actually of these characters that you have are so sort of revealing. We get a sense of who they are just by their names, like Randy Fairlow or Rodney Hind. And
right,
one of the things that I kept thinking about, because there's really a narrative arc in this collection, right? I mean, at least as I perceived it. In the beginning, there are sort of poems of coming of age, kind of youth and teenage life maybe in that part of the world. And then they evolve towards, and you have these sort of spiritual reckoning. And then all of a sudden, you latter poems are about fatherhood and things like that. Tell me a little bit about that narrative arc and why you constructed the book that way.
Well, I didn't want – yeah, I mean, there is – I tried to construct some sort of narrative arc in this book. That's absolutely true. You know, the one thing I didn't want to do is to just kind of dump all the poems I'd ever written into a book.
Right. Yeah.
And I obviously didn't do that, you know, because, you know, I'm going over these binders full of poems. You know, I had like 200-300 poems.
Right.
And I you kind of have to put them up like on this metaphorical clothesline and say, okay, I've got them all in a row here. What goes where and how do they all fit together?
Right. Yeah.
And so the thought process, I kind of thought, start the book with coming of age, you know, which seems like it's been done, but, you know, it's important to do that.
For sure.
You know, and then I went right into this disaster thing with these plague poems. And
right,
then you're right. There's kind of a reconciliation slash fatherhood slash music,
mm-hmm,
you know, where it kind of all comes together at the end of the book, I'm hoping, to show that arc. And it kind of also shows that the characters and the speakers in the poems, they're still going through a process, even at the end of the book. And
yeah,
I try to make that clear in the last poem, The Burying Ground, that there's still these questions, and the questions will remain.
We're talking with Elijah Burrell, poet and author of the new collection, The Skin of the River, out by Aldrich Press. Eli, you also, we've mentioned the word music several times. And I know you're a musician. Tell me how does music play a role in your writing? Or does it?
it totally does. I mean, so music came early for me. My parents didn't have a lot of money, but one thing they always seemed to do was carry around their record collection, no matter where we ended up. They'd have a box full of records, and, you know, they weren't always the coolest records by anyone else's standards, but, you know, my dad was really into bluegrass. My mom was into what we would call classic rock now, but also into, like, swing music and other types of jazz music. And so we always had those records at home, and I would listen to them continuously as I was growing up. And my dad played guitar, so there was always a guitar or two laying around, and I taught myself how to play. And then when I got a little bit older, dad was a disc jockey at like our local community radio station.
Nice, that's great.
He did a bluegrass radio show,
and
so I got to be on the radio some, and But the station had like a room called the Big Room. And in the Big Room, it housed, Tim, literally thousands of vinyl albums and CDs, like these old reel-to-reel tapes.
It was
really easy to get lost.
It's like Mecca.
Yes.
It's like musical Mecca.
If you're a music fan, absolutely.
Sure.
You know, or if you're just like coming into music. So while I'm listening to all this music, and I've thought about this because I've done a few interviews before this one, and it's all kind of come together in my brain, but, you know, I'm listening to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, of course, and then I'm listening to like people like Bill Monroe and John Hartford and Muddy Waters and like all these different musicians, these different genres, and I'm writing while I'm doing that. You know, I'm writing stories, comic books. I was doing radio plays. Song lyrics, all that. But it wasn't kind of until a bit later that I started trying to move kind of all those things into the poetry.
Right.
But, you know, I would say that the singing, the playing, that came first before the poems.
Mm-hmm.
And so they found their way into the poems. And it's been kind of weird because, you know, directly after Mom passed in December, besides my family, like the thing that got me through was going back to those old records. I actually took her record collection.
Wow.
And I revisited, like, my old obsessions and her old obsessions like, Dylan and the Beatles.
Yes.
And, Tim, it wasn't Yeats or Wordsworth that was getting me through, you know, which is crazy because I love these old poets, but it was Dylan and the Fab Four, you know?
I do know.
You know, and I'll be honest, also, like, reading work by, you know, my friends that are writers, it made me feel like they were there with me.
Sure.
And so it's like, you know, my friends and then, you know, the four guys from Liverpool and Bob Dylan coming in out of the cold and talking to me. So music kept me, you know, it kept me going. And music is, it's all over this book, and it is important to me. And I do play, I do record songs. And one of the best ways I know to kind of blow off steam is to go into a room alone and just play a song.
So Eli, would you mind reading us here at Words on a Wire, a selection from your book?
Sure, I'd love to. I'll read the first poem that's in the book. It's called Change of Song.
Great.
Change of Song. I've had truck with the devil, run on hubris, a skeptic mess. I've slithered and lurked, lugged around a scurrilous heart and mind, been blind, built an altar to womankind and lain with phonies. These hands are depraved diddlers both, though baptized and bathed. Oh, to climb the wing-beaten steps, lay down my head in the warmth of golden straw for your flock instead of hell's ruck. My mouth is diamonds, a crystal moon, a parachute. May it drop me to an even place. My hands are numb. My heart is a field of blood to be won.
And with that, we've been talking with Eli Burrell, author of Skin of the River by Aldrich Press. Eli, thank you so much for joining us here on Words on a Wire.
Oh, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm Kitsani Montaña-Sevilla, and for my poetic license today, I'm going to be singing a song that I wrote. It's basically an ode to enjoying life no matter how rough it gets. Am I crazy? Am I a fool? I must have fallen through the rabbit hole, 'cause Toto, we're not in Kansas, and I'm looking past the wishing well. Woke up this morning and stepped out the door. I felt more sure than ever before and decided to not be sad anymore. So come my way, I'm ready for ya. My world is flip-flopped upside down. My feet have been searching for some common ground, but nothing good can come from running. I'm spinning and turning and constantly wondering, am I crazy? Am I a fool? I Must have fallen through the rabbit hole, 'cause Toto, we're not in Kansas, and I'm looking past the wishing well. Ooh. Once I can love again. The turtle and the hare are my friends, and with them I can understand the lesson I need to learn at hand. You can't have a house without a good foundation, and you can't use force to move a mountain. No, you gotta build and climb to the end, then turn around and do it again. 'Cause life is crazy and life is full, and life is sad and happy too. And one day you will finally see that everything was meant to be. 'Cause you're not crazy and you're not a fool, and you didn't fall through the rabbit hole. And Toto, you don't need Kansas, and you sure don't need a wishing well. 'Cause we're not crazy, we're not all fools, and we didn't fall through the rabbit hole. And Toto, we don't need Kansas, and we sure don't need a wishing well. Ooh.
That was Quetzani Montaño Sevilla blessing us with her beautiful voice on Poetic License. I'm Tim Hernandez, and thanks for tuning in. We've been speaking with poet Elijah Burrell, whose debut collection, The Skin of the River, was published by Aldrich Press, and you want to be sure to pick that up. Also, thank you to our Poetic License guest artist, Quetzani Montaño Sevilla. And that wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. As my co-host likes to say, don't forget, the next book you read could save your life.
Why are you still crying? Your pain is now through. Please forgive those teardrops. Let me take them from you. The love you are blessed with, this world's waiting for. So let us